Well, actually, mathematics. Why nothing works. The 20th century saw a lot of attempts to solve the basic problems, and in 1993, Putnam concluded that it's all bust. Nobody knows what's going on. So, the danger in philosophy is people who learn it superficially, who take a course here and there, and they get a professor who thinks he knows the truth, and he teaches a very selective set of sources. If you really get into it, you find that it's really just confusion. But in the confusion, there is a number of important philosophers who hold positions that are very friendly to ours. Indeed, some would even say that they're representing evidence in favor of positions very much like ours. There's a fellow, one of the leaders in what's called philosophy of mind, a fellow named David Chalmers, who recently wrote a paper about consciousness. Some of this stuff we're going to talk about tonight. He says there are 6 theories of what the mind is. 3 would make the mind into a piece of meat, particularly your brain. And 3 would make it something that isn't physical at all. He says if you look carefully at the 3 that would make your mind into a piece of meat, they face insuperable objections and should be discarded. The 3 that say that your mind is not physical at all are the best theories. And he says all of them deserve to be developed because at present they're the best theories that we have. 1 of the 3 is the idea that the mind is a separate thing, like a soul, and it's separate, it's different from the body, and the mind and the body interact. Things that happen to the body affect the mind, things that happen to the mind affect the body, which is a view that we have held for over 3,000 years. And I can tell you that when I was going to college, when I was going to graduate school, you couldn't even talk about that view. That view was considered to be so foolish, so ridiculous, so outmoded, thrown away 150 years ago, that it wasn't even a matter of discussion. Now here's one of the world's leaders telling us that theory is one of the really going theories. And others, the ones that are popularized in the press and in the lower level university classes, that of course everything is a physical machine, he says those theories have faced such terrible obstacles that they shouldn't even be developed. They're just not worth considering. So there are things in contemporary philosophy which are really very friendly to our point of view. I thought it would be worthwhile for your own understanding, also if you need to, in discussion with others, convey the idea that what you're doing not just on the basis of blind faith, but that there are secular philosophers who hold positions that are similar to ours, so that you can show that, 1, our position is not simply discarded or rejected by contemporary philosophy, and 2, that you have some understanding of these matters so that you're not out of touch with what's going on. And I chose for the first subject the soul. The overwhelming prejudice among undergraduates is that modern science shows you that the world is nothing but a machine, and belief in a soul is primitive and superstitious. That's what they say. They say it because they don't know, because they're ignorant of what's going on in philosophy. But tonight I want to try to take you through one very important argument. It really first came to light in the work of Saul Kripke in the 70s and 80s, and Thomas Nagel has been pushing it from a paper that he wrote even in the 60s. To the present day, David Chalmers follows this line, as do some others. Now, I'm boiling it down for you. You guys aren't trained in philosophy. These papers are written for professionals in philosophy. I'm trying to put it into everyday terms, but as best I understand it, all the basic ideas are there. Let's think about how science discovers things. A lot of things that science discovers are like this. Something happens, and we want to know why it happens, how it happens, what makes it happen. And so we gather together what we know about the thing, and then we look for the answer, why and how it happens. Very often, what we know about the thing is We know what causes it, what makes it happen. And we know what effects it has. And this thing we're looking for is in between. It sits in the middle. I know that these particular items cause it. I know that when it happens, it gives forth to these particular effects. And my problem is, what's sitting in the middle that's carrying us from these causes to those effects? I'll give you an example. Let's take sound. Now, we know that when you bang a drum, or when there's a rock slide, or when there's a fire burning, or then, in the end, we hear things. But of course, the guy's banging the drum over there, and I hear it over here. So there's got to be something in between. Sound is the name for the thing in between, which his banging the drum causes. Then this sound gets created. And that sound that gets created somehow causes me to have an experience of hearing. Now we notice that it's banging on drums and fires and rock slides and thunder, which seems to be usually associated with lightning. And then I get these sensations of sounds. Sometimes it just gets ringing in my ears, and you know, nothing going on outside. What do I know about this sound that's in between? I have some, because of the way it acts, because of the things it does, I have some information about the kind of thing it should be. For example, you can block it. Sound is coming from the hall, you close the door, you block out a lot of the sound. The farther away you are from a sound, the weaker it sounds, weaker the experience you have, the less you hear. Sound bounces. Echoes. The source of the sound is over there. There's a wall there. Somebody hears it over there. So for all these reasons, it certainly looks like sound is a physical thing. It's caused by banging on drums. And it can be contained if you put a barrier in the way. And it gets weaker the farther away you are. And you can bounce it off walls. It certainly behaves like a physical thing. It acts like a physical thing. The only trouble is, when he bangs the drum, and I hear it, there's nothing in between. Look, wave your hand, you know, put out a pop and try to catch it. There's nothing there. That's the mystery. This thing behaves like a physical thing, and there's nothing there. You can imagine how for thousands of years people thought about this, and it's really mysterious. Because on the one hand, it's caused by physical things. On the other hand, it causes an effect in me. On the third hand, the way it operates is the way in which physical things operate. And yet, there doesn't seem to be anything there. So you're hunting for something that does these things. Now, I'm going to introduce a word here just to make things short. We're talking about how sound functions. Functions is short for what kinds of things produce it and what kind of effects it produces. We'll call that the function of sound. And what we've seen in sound is that its functioning is the kind of functioning you expect from a physical object. Only, as they say, we look around, we wave our hands in between, put up with this paper, you know, or fresh paint, nothing happens. We don't capture any physical. You know, if there were a very thin blue ray, they put on special glasses, you see the blue rays coming, oh, there they are. That's it, that's the sound, the blue rays. We didn't see them before. You need something physical that's there that does the job. Now, before it was discovered, I'm sure you all know what sound is, but just thinking back to this time of mystery, you know, if someone would say to you, did you ever think of weighing sound? Trying to do an experiment to see how much sound weighs? I think people would find that utterly mysterious. Weigh a sound? Well, how could you weigh it? We don't even know what it is. But it's just not, you know, you wave your hand, it's not there. How can you weigh something that's not there? So what they discover? They discover the sound is waves of air particles. Waves of air particles. Air particles are bouncing back and forth, and they go in successive waves, and they beat against each other, but they're very, very fast. Tens of seconds. And they bang against your eardrums, and the eardrums are very sensitive, and the eardrums are quivering like that, and the eardrum quivering like that, it gives you the sensation of sound. How do I know that that's the right answer? Well, for one thing, it works like that. If you set up a door, so then it's going to be much harder for the air particles to bounce against one another and get in. Farther away you are, the weaker the bouncing of the air is. If you bounce these waves against the wall, they're going to bounce off that way. Just, you know, waves of air bouncing seems to fit the job. Then you have the acid test, trying to make a sound in a vacuum. Nothing happens. You see that? Look at that. We've got proof. Because without air, there is no sound. No sound on the moon. That's an example of a discovery. What you start with is how the thing functions. How the thing functions means what causes it and what is it, what are its effects. It, I don't know anything about. Well, I might know something about it. I know some of the things that it does. But what it is that's doing these things, I don't know. Now this is crucial, because when I think about sounds, before science explains what it is, my idea of sound has a big hole in the center. All I have about sound is what causes it and what it causes. In the center, where it's sitting, is a big hole. I have no idea what's filling the hole. I know something about it. It ought to be a physical thing. Some kind of physical thing. But what physical thing? What kind of physical thing? I haven't a clue. And now, by the way, once you agree that it's airwaves, you can weigh a sound. You can weigh the air. And you know how much the sound weighs. So all of a sudden, this idea, which before was incomprehensible, I had no idea what it meant, all of a sudden now we understand what it means, and we can sort of see how to do it. A great many discoveries in science are like that. You start with the idea of a thing, all you know are its functions. What it is, you haven't a clue. You have no positive information about what it is. All you know is what it does. You hunt for something that does those things, you find something that does those things. You're all free. What is heat? 400 years ago, the going idea was that heat is a substance. You put a hot thing and a cold thing together, the cold thing will warm up. Why? Because some heat is flowing. We even talk that way. We talk about heat flowing? Heat flow? That's because it's borrowed from the older time. Some heat is flowing from the one to the other. That was the theory. So, if you think of heat as a substance flowing from one to the other, one natural thing you would expect is that hot things will, yeah, they'll cool down, but because you test it directly, hot things should weigh more than cold things. Right? Because they've got more of that substance. Right? But they don't. So, it was a problem. Maybe the heat is very, very thin, you know, very light kind of substance, and it's very hard to measure with our very gross scales that don't measure carefully. At any rate, in the end, what they discovered is that heat is the molecules moving. The faster they move, the more heat there is. The slower they move, the less heat there is. By the way, it should be qualified as random motion. Not all motion counts. Just throw a baseball very fast in one direction, it doesn't make it hotter. It's the random jiggling of the molecules, not organized motion. Now, when you put a hot and cold thing together, so the hot ones are moving faster, and the cold is moving slower, so by banging against each other, the faster ones speed up the slower ones, the slower ones slow down the faster ones. The middle of the hot one gets cooler, and the cooler one gets hot. And if you catalog all the things that heat does, and all the things that produce heat, and you check, you find that increased molecular motion always does it. Nobody dreamt that was true 400 years ago. They had a different theory about what it was. Again, I know how it functions. I know what it does. I know what causes it. I know what it causes. But I don't know what it is. There's a big hole in the center of the idea. And science fills in that hole. When science discovers something that fills the hole, that's a good reason to say they've discovered the thing. Third example, I'm going to introduce a little wrinkle, and then I'm going to go to our problem. You have a computer system. And you notice that from time to time, it goes down. There are glitches. What's causing the glitches? So, there are a number of possibilities. It could be the inherent weakness of the physical elements. All physical elements wear out sooner or later. It could be industrial espionage. You know, you have enemies who want to slow down your production, so they're sabotaging your computers. Could be that mice get in at night, you know, and skip around and chew some of the wires. It could be the dust in the room. That it could be lots of different things. It could be there's free electricity in the air, or too many cell phones, and there's too many microwaves, which disturb the electrical patterns. There could be lots and lots of different things. Or something you don't know about. It could be another effect that you're not aware of that's disrupting the thing. There, it's pretty open. What's disrupting the system is pretty open. All you know is that it disrupts it. And you can start doing an investigation to find out what it is. And there are a lot of different possibilities. Mice, fleas, microwaves, anyway, espionage, lots of different theories, and you have to try to figure out which one it is. Suppose now you install cameras, 24-hour cameras, hidden cameras, and you get pictures of people sneaking into the computer room at 1 a.m. and playing around with their keyboards. Then all the other theories disappear. It's not mice, and it's not microwaves, and it's not the inherent weakness of the hardware. No. It's sabotage, because I have pictures of the people. I don't have now an idea with a hole in the center. I have an idea where the center is filled in very nicely. All I got to do is send their pictures to the FBI, and we'll be finished with this problem. When you have the center filled in, when you have a positive picture of what's doing the job, then the idea of discovering some cause by some kind of scientific investigation is no longer relevant. It's only where you have a hole in the center of the concept, where I only know what's causing it, then it goes into the hole, then we'll have time in the hole. Then I know what comes out, what it causes, but the hole is empty, then I'm free to look for something that does the job and say, that's what the thing really is. That's the picture. Okay. Now let's come to the mind. Let's see what we know about the mind. And let's see what are the prospects for discovering that the mind is really the brain. This is what they'll all tell you, especially the cognitive scientists. Maybe there ought to be scare quotes on that. Cognitive scientists? Question mark. That's what they'll all tell you, that the mind is really the brain. Let's see what kinds of things are in the mind and see whether they are candidates for this kind of discovery. Let's start with some that are. Let's take memory. What do we know about memory? Well, we know that certain kinds of experiences lead people and animals to remember things. And when people and animals remember things, then they can do certain things which they couldn't do without the memory. The rat learns the maze. Next time, he doesn't start trying every possible way randomly. No, he runs straight through to the end to get his reward because he remembers. So what do I have? I have certain types of experiences give memory. People or animals with memory can do various kinds of things. What's the memory in between? I have a foggy thing. I don't know what it is. It's just something in between. I know what kinds of experiences create memory. I know what memory gives the ability to do. But what memory is, I don't know. I do know something about it. For one thing, if you bang a guy in the brain, you can cause him to lose his memory. Well, I guess that means that the memory is something in the brain. Because if you bang him on the brain, it doesn't do. You do certain kinds of surgery in the brain, so you can cut it out. So it's got to be something about the brain. But what? What's going on in the brain that would be memory? Well, every 10 years you have a new theory. I don't think anybody, even to this day, has a good explanation of what memory is. We know where to look for it. But we don't know what it is. But we know what it means to solve the problem. You got to find something in the brain that does these things. You got to find something in the brain which, when you have certain experiences, that thing in the brain gets organized in a certain way. And then, when the brain is organized in that way, you can do various things. Even if you artificially produce the organization, you know, by sticking in needles or something, wouldn't matter. Got the organization, and you can do these things. So memory is the right kind of thing. It's like sound. Memory is like sound. You start off knowing the functions of memory, but not having a clue what memory is. Sort of know where it is, but you don't know what it is. And then you hunt and hunt and hunt for a thing in there that has these functions. When you find something that has these functions, you have every right to say you've discovered what memory is. Intelligence. Intelligence usually is measured by the capacity to solve novel problems. Problems that you haven't solved before. And if you do that, you can measure all of the different kinds of intelligence, different areas of intelligence. So we know what intelligence does. And we know certain kinds of experiences that produce it, don't produce it. For example, school destroys it. And certain kinds of school, anyway. Yeshiva produces it. But what is intelligence? Well, again, if you bang someone on the brain, the intelligence, at least temporarily, goes out the window. If you do surgery on the brain, you can modify or destroy the intelligence. So it's probably something in the brain. But what it is in the brain, we don't know. So intelligence is another thing that's part of the mind. And it's a concept of the hole in it, the hole in the center. So since it has a hole in the center, we can go looking for something that plugs the hole. Something that is produced by these experiences. Something which, when you have it, enables you to solve novel problems. Anything I'll find in the brain that does those functions, it'll be fair to say we've discovered what intelligence is. Now, a lot of the things that the mind holds, like memory, like intelligence, like information, are really functional. What does it mean to know things? What is knowledge? Well, we know knowledge is produced by certain experiences, and knowledge gives you the ability to do certain things. That's it. Then the knowledge is in between there someplace. But if you ask me what knowledge is, you get a blank. Again, it's in the brain, because you bang the brain, you can't use your knowledge, and surgery destroys it. But what in the brain is the knowledge? Well, you're hunting it to find it. But we know what it would be like to find it. To find something that has those functions, it would be fair to say that we've discovered what knowledge is. Okay, that's all stage study. Now we've come to the problem. The problem is there are certain things about the mind that don't have a hole in the center. They don't have a hole in the center. On the contrary, the hole in the center is full. I know what's in there. I know what it is. I know what kinds of characteristics it has. And if I know what kinds of characteristics it has, then this whole pattern of discovery seems to be irrelevant. Yeah, it may do functions also. But it's not only doing functions. It also has something that fills the center. And then the idea of using this pattern of scientific analysis seems to go to pieces. Here's an example. Let's take the experience of pain. Being in pain. Feeling the pain. Now, on the one hand, experience of pain, the conscious experience of pain, does have functions. No question about it. Somebody steps on your toe, that will cause you to feel pain. And if you're in pain, well, you're likely to say, ouch. You're likely to respond to the fellow in certain other ways. A certain behavior can be prompted by being in pain. So, part of pain is functions. There's no doubt about that. Nobody is denying it. But there's another part of pain. And that is the actual conscious experience of the pain. The feeling of the pain. What the pain is not a mystery. It's not like sound. Gosh, I don't know what's doing that. What could it be? Gremlins? Little blue lights? You know, little blue beams? Air? How could it be air? Look at that. Surprise, surprise. It's air. With sound, you start out with a hole in the center. You haven't a clue what's going on in the hole. With pain, the hole is filled with your conscious experience of the pain. You know what it feels like from first-hand experience. You're not searching for what the pain is. You know what the pain is. So now, if I'm going to go searching for pain in the brain, I need two things. I need something that does the functions of pain. Yeah, I want something in the brain that's effective when somebody steps on your toe. Right? Something in the brain's got to tweak or twiggle or, you know, light up or go magnetic when he steps on your toe. And that thing that's buzzing around in your brain ought to be connected to your saying, ouch, yes. Pain definitely has certain functions. But also, there's the conscious, felt experience of pain. Now, how am I going to find that in the brain? What would it mean to find it in there? What pattern do I have for finding it in there? What kind of scientific theory did we ever have in the history of science that was like this, where you took something which you knew very well what it was, and found it someplace else, and discovered it in an area where it's not just not visible? What would it mean to find the conscious experience of pain in the brain? The problem here is not, we don't know enough about the brain. That's not the problem. We don't know enough about the brain for memory either. We don't know enough about the brain for intelligence either. We don't know enough about the brain for knowledge either. We don't care. We got the solution to any of those problems. But in the first three, we know what the solution would be like. We know what the program is for finding the solution. We know what success of the program would be. We have a program to work on. Here, we don't know what the program is. We don't know what success would look like. The problem here is a philosophical problem. It's a conceptual problem. I'll give you some more analogies and some aspects to think about. You have a North Pole and a South Pole. Where do compasses point to? North. Turns out it's not exactly true. Not exactly north. It's, under the ice. At a certain point, close to the North Pole. Not exactly north. That you could discover. Follow your compass. Let's see where it leads you. It leads you to the most north place, or doesn't lead you to the most north place. So you can discover, is the North Pole at the magnetic North Pole, or is the magnetic North Pole off the North Pole? Some extent. Discover something like that. Suppose someone asked you, where is the number 6? Are you hiding it under your bed at home? We need it, you know. The number 6 is very useful. Not nice of you to hoard it that way. No, I'll bet it's at Fort Knox. Those guys have locked up all the gold, and they've locked up the number 6 also. They want to use it. That's the Americans, you know. Everything's for them. Right? Where is the number 6? That question has no meaning. The number 6 isn't the kind of thing that's in one place or another place. The number 6 isn't just isn't that kind of thing. Suppose somebody asks, what is the number 6? What is it? Could someone say, I think it's a certain species of mouse. That's what I think it is. Somebody says, no, it's butterflies. So what are you talking about? It's cobalt, radioactive cobalt. That's what the number 6 is. These aren't even beginners, because it's just not in our concepts to use a physical object as a number. Numbers don't do the things that physical objects do. And I know what the number 6 is. I'm not searching for something that has functions. I know what it is. I can count with it. I can multiply with it. I can see it in my mind's eye. I know how to generate it. So somebody says, well, the number 6 really is oranges. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't know where he's coming from. I don't know what he wants me to think. The words don't say anything to me. If somebody says to me that heat is a substance, I know what he's saying. I know what he means, and I can test it. And indeed, we tested it and found out that it's wrong. Somebody says to me that heat, that sound is little blue rays, I can test it. I can try to see whether you can make sound in a vacuum. Do the little blue rays go out in a vacuum? No? Well, then, there's something wrong there. I understand what it means to say sound is little blue rays. I understand what it means to say the sound is airwaves, which, until the 19th century, people would have thought you were mad. Airwaves? See, the air is waving? Listen, put up your hands over here. You feel any air waving? Don't give me your silly stories about air waving. We know what it means. We know how to test it. We know how to discover that it happens to be true or it might have been false. Somebody tells you the number 6 is pumpkins. It's not like that. It's not a candidate for discovery, a candidate for investigation. I don't know where to begin. I don't know what he's talking about. Now, saying that, the conscious felt pain is something that's going on in the brain is a little bit like saying the number 6 is turnips. The conscious felt experience, when I open up the brain, what I see is cells that have electrical potential, and they discharge electrical potential by passing ions from one place to another, and they recover because they reionize the atoms, and, you know, I see all that. But some will say, yeah, but you got to look more carefully. If you look more carefully, you'll see the pain. I don't know what he's talking about. How am I going to hunt for a pain in a lump of mush, you know, a lump of gray flesh? Where's it going to be? In the vertical fold? In the horizontal fold? In the pink parts. I know, the pain is in the pink part. Because pink, pain, you know, begins the same letter. I mean, where's the connection between the two? Some philosophers use the following observation. Can you imagine someone who looks human? He can open up his body, he can open up his brain, looks human, but has no conscious experience at all. They call him a zombie. Can you imagine such a thing? A person who looks like you and functions like you and brains wired like yours, but it just doesn't feel anything. Most people don't have a difficulty in imagining that. Indeed, some philosophers coming from the other end ask you, how do you know other people think or feel at all? Maybe they're just very complicated machines. So if I'm supposed to take that question seriously, gosh, maybe you're all machines and I'm the only one having any experiences. Must be possible to conceive that there would be something that looks like a human being and has no experiences. Okay, if you can conceive of that, now, tell me, what is it that you could discover in the person's brain that would convince you were wrong? I think maybe you have no experiences at all. You're just a very complicated machine. Now I open up your brain and I start untying the neurons, you know, and checking the connections and the electrical potentials and the color and the fluid, you know, and all the glial cells and all the rest. I say, oh, well, listen, if you find 4,000 glial cells standing on their heads in one place, then definitely there's a pain there. But what's the connection? The glial cells are like this and the neurons are like that and the electrical potentials are like that. That's going to convince you that this person really feels things and isn't a zombie? I don't know what to look for. I don't know what it would mean to find the answer. That's not like memory. With memory, I knew very well what it would mean to find the answer. I need to find something in the brain that's produced by these experiences and produces those effects. Anything that does that is fair to call memory. But with pain, it's not just functions. With pain, I have the experience of it. I've filled in the sensor. The sensor is this conscious, felt experience. I don't know what it means to look for a conscious, felt experience in the brain. I don't know how to describe the project. So as I say, it's not a question of doing more scientific research, because I don't know what I'm researching for. I don't know what the conditions are of succeeding in the project. This, according to these philosophers, means that our concepts are set up in such a way today that there's no project to even engage in. What you would have to do to solve this problem is change the concepts. You have to change the concepts, which has happened in the history of human thought. It usually takes thousands of years, and it's a very big job, and it's a very radical move. Concepts have changed. But as of today, the way we think about the brain, and the way we think about a conscious experience, we have no way to even describe what it would be to build a bridge between the two of them. We don't even have a way to describe a scientific project for building a bridge. We don't know what it would mean to say that conscious experience is in the brain. Well, we all have conscious experience. Although some philosophers, in desperation, have tried to deny that. Conscious experience is just an illusion. I suppose an illusion is also an experience? No, it's an illusion of having an illusion, or something like that. The best philosophers, in my view, the most honest philosophers say, listen, everybody knows he feels pain from time to time, and feels pleasure from time to time, and other feelings, other emotions. We all are aware of our conscious experience, and if we don't have a good way to explain what it means to find it, I'm not saying we haven't found it. We don't know what it means to find it. So that's so, then, just saying over and over again, like a mantra, the mind is the brain, the mind is the brain, the mind is the brain, is mindless. There's no reason for it. Indeed, there's plenty of reason to say that it ain't so. Now, this is part of the reason that Chalmers says that these materialistic theories at present haven't got a prayer. And that's why we shouldn't be barking up that tree at the present time, because at the present time, we don't know what it would mean to make it work. Questions up to here?
If you cut out part of the brain and you don't feel pain, I'm not sure about this pain.
Okay, now this, you're right to mention that. Nagel does say that on the same grounds that we said that sound ought to be something physical, because the way it behaves is like a physical thing. You can bounce it off walls, and you stick up a door, you can block it, and the further away you get, the weaker the sound gets. So there are correlations between conscious experience and the brain, which make it seem that it ought to be a physical thing. You're right. You're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I should have mentioned it myself. I had it in mind. I didn't write out notes, so I forgot. So there's external evidence in the way in which it operates that it ought to be a physical thing. That's correct. The only trouble is that I can't describe what it would mean to get the center to work, because I'm not dealing just with functions. I'm dealing with something that has a positive description. So I'm really here at a kind of contradiction in my thought. On the one hand, I have reason to think that it ought to be physical. And on the other hand, I don't know what it would mean. I can't describe what it would mean to discover that it really is physical. That's why someone like Thomas Nagel, who's a committed physicalist, he wants everything to be material, says at present we don't have a clue how to solve this problem. And the only way to solve it is to hope someday that our conscience will be changed. What we need to do is somehow take the concept of pain and import a whole. What we really want is a whole at the center. That's what we want. We want to make pain like memory and like sound and like heat. You know, we want to push a hole into the center. The trouble is right now the center is filled with the conscious experience. So somehow we've got to jiggle it around and push the conscious experience to one side and make room for a hole and have them live side by side and then do the job with the hole, which will do the job for the conscious experience also. So those words, as I speak them now, are against the concepts we have, so they're like gobbledygook. So someone like Thomas Nagel says, let's hope and pray that someday someone will jiggle the concepts and will be able to do it. Other people say, hoping for a conceptual revolution is like, you know, hoping for Madame Godot. Face the fact that at present, the way we think about it, there is no such thing. And if so, we have to try other possibilities. Now, the other possibility is our possibility. Our possibility is, which was Descartes' possibility because he was religious, is that there's a soul, and the soul and the brain are put into connection with one another. So that at present they depend upon one another. So indeed, what happens to your brain is going to affect your conscious experience because they interact with one another. Not because the soul is the brain or the mind is the brain, but they're connected to one another. And so that way I can explain why if you act on the brain, you'll cause things in the conscious experience and vice versa, without having to say that the conscious experience is in the brain, because when I say the conscious experience is in the brain, at present I'm just speaking nonsense. Yeah?
The calling of the soul doesn't bring us any closer to understanding what the conscious experience of pain.
Well, let's start this way. The first step in understanding is facing the facts. It's very easy to fool yourself into thinking you're understanding something by just eliminating half the facts. Because then there's less to do. It's a much easier job because you're not doing the whole job. A person who turns his back on conscious experience will get understanding. He'll get understanding the way you got it for heat, and the way you got it for sound, and the way you get it for memory. All he talks about is functions. There are people like that, like Daniel Dennett and other people. But for these philosophers that I quoted, and I think from almost all people unpolluted by philosophy, conscious experience is obvious. To tell me you've solved the problem by leaving out conscious experience is just to say you haven't faced the problem. So, have we got understanding of conscious experience? Not yet. Now, David Chalmers just wrote a paper, I just took it off the internet, called The Prospect for a Science of Consciousness, and he lays out about 10 projects that this science could address, some of which are already being addressed and some already being worked on. There's plenty to do without reducing conscious experience to the brain, leaving it as two things, and discovering each one its own structure and how they interact with one another, what the correlation, the NCC, the neural correlate of consciousness. You know, there's a lot of work that can be done. Just this aspect is not going to happen because, at present anyway, they look like two different things. Now, There is a standard objection against this view, which I'll explain to you, and I'll tell you what the answer to it is, and that'll be enough for tonight. Then maybe you can take a vote whether you want to continue this, or it's so boring that it's just impossible to digest. Some people say, you're telling me that the soul and the brain interact. Things that happen in the brain cause you to feel things, cause you to think things. Things that happen in the soul cause the mind to go, the brain to go fire one way or another. How could that be? After all, you're telling me that the soul is not a physical thing. How could a physical thing and a thing that isn't physical connect? How could they have an effect on one another? All the cases of effect that we know is one physical thing affecting another physical thing. The white billiard ball rolls and hits the black billiard ball, and the black billiard ball rolls into the pocket. Right? It's one ball affecting another ball. Push something with your hand. The fire burns the paper. It's one physical thing acting on another physical thing. You're telling me you've got a completely non-physical thing. A thing that has no physical nature. And you're telling me what it interacts with the brain? That's just beyond belief. It's beyond all comprehension. Isn't that a good enough reason to reject the idea? That you're describing it as an interaction where, from all our experience, it can't be an interaction like that. Well, I thought of an answer to this about 25 years ago, and I was very gratified to see that David Chalmers, I mean, I didn't publish it, so he doesn't owe me anything, but David Chalmers uses the same answer in one of his recent papers. I don't know if you'll ever read or if you've ever heard of David Hume, except that I mention him from time to time. One of the most famous things that Hume wrote was a critique of causality. According to Hume, we haven't the foggiest idea what causality is with billiard balls either. I've described this to some of you when we talked about nature and talked about miracles. The white ball rolls, it hits the black ball goes into the pocket. I see all the rolling of the balls, I don't see the causality. All I see is things happening. Happening in order, happening over and over again. I put the raw egg into the boiling water, 5 minutes later I take it out, it's a hard-boiled egg. I saw the egg go in, I saw the timer go around 5 minutes, I took the egg out, it was liquid before, it's solid now. I see a stream of events, I don't see any causing there, in addition to the stream of the events. Causation, says Hume, either it's a total mystery, or it's just a name for the fact that events follow each other in a pattern. That's all. Now, since Hume wrote that, it has become a great challenge, or a great embarrassment, if you like, the philosophy, that there's no accepted solution to this problem. 300 years. No accepted solution to the problem. So, says Chalmers, I hardly agree. Don't tell me that the billiard balls are really perfectly understood. We got it down to a science. We have a theory that explains it. We can define it and describe it. But when it comes to the soul, it's a mystery because the billiard balls are a mystery. So, it's not obvious that we're any worse off if we add in the souls. And if you're talking about experience, we, who believe in souls, will say that we do have experience. We have experience of the soul causing physical things to move. Like when you decide to lift your hand. The decision goes on in the soul and the hand goes up. So, that happens to me every moment of my life. I feel within me directly the decision, which is the soul and the body, responding. Why isn't my experience, my observation of my experience, just as good as my observation of billiards tables? I watch the billiard table, I see the white ball hit the black ball, and the black ball goes in the pocket. I am conscious of my own decision, and my hand goes up. They're both correlated, they happen over and over again, they happen in regular, repeatable categories of events. I'm inclined to call them both causation. So, I don't see any reason to be embarrassed when someone says, how can a non-physical thing cause a physical thing? We don't know how physical things cause physical things. And in terms of experience, I experience my decisions causing things, and I experience things happening to my body causing effects in my conscious experience, which we have no reason to think is the brain. So I experience it directly, just as much as I experience doing this table. So I don't think we should be embarrassed about the idea of causation at all. And therefore, here's a whole piece of philosophy which gives evidence for something that's not physical, which is where conscious experience takes place. And as Chalmers says, it's quite congenial to our brain. With me so far? There's one other point to add here. In the 60s, Thomas Nagel wrote a paper called "What Is It Like to Be a Bat?" That's, you know, one of those winged mouse-like creatures that fly around in dark caves and finding their way by echolocation, squeaking high-pitched squeaks listening to the echoes and catching mosquitoes on the run on the basis of the echoes. Now, a lot of people misunderstood Nagel's paper. The point of Nagel's paper is this. When you have an experience, the experience is had from a point of view. When I think of that bat racing around that cave, almost totally blind, in the dark, so you can't see anything anyhow, and doing it by echolocation and catching mosquitoes on the wing, I realize that his experience has got to be very different from mine. It's got to feel different from mine. It's got to be focused different from mine. It's got to be organized different from mine. For example, suppose you fitted me with earphones and a thing I blow into, which creates a high-pitched squeak, and the earphones pick up the squeaks, and then the squeaks cause visual patterns in front of my eyes, and then I catch the flies, and I can, you know, I've got to give it a jetpack on my back, and I'm flying around, right? Would I then have some way of appreciating what it's like to be a bat? Not really, because it would be a human being flying around, a human being wearing earphones, a human being catching mosquitoes. All of this is experienced from my point of view. What you recognize when you're dealing with a bat is that it has a different point of view. It starts out from a different orientation, a different focus. When you have an experience, you bring with it, you bring to it all of what you know and all your prior experiences and all of what its purposes are. The bat doesn't have any of that. On the other hand, for the bat, those chirps fill its mind. Chirps don't fill your mind. With human beings, it's a little less dramatic, but the same point is that sometimes you say, see it from my point of view. That requires a leap of imagination. If you know the person reasonably well, you know his background, you know his culture, you could do it. You say, yeah, it doesn't seem that way to me, but I can understand how it seems to you. We recognize that every experience comes from a certain point of view. It has a certain focus, certain structures, certain orientation. To really understand someone's experience, you have to take up his point of view. And we're better or worse at doing this, you know. If you know somebody for a long time, it's easy to take up his point of view. If you're playing chess with somebody, the only way you can predict his next move is by taking up his point of view. If you play chess for a while with people and you know their style, you can do that. Yeah, he'll take the pawn, because that's the kind of player he is. But you know that to appreciate his experience, you have to do that. You have to jump into his shoes and take up his point of view. Okay, that means that experience is essentially subjective, meaning that it comes from a point of view. To describe an experience and to do justice to it, what you have to write into the description is the point of view from which it's coming. If you leave that out, you have not done justice to that experience. Now, says Nagel, imagine opening up the brain. What are you going to see there? Nerve cells and electrical impulses and ions going back and forth, and synapses and blood and that kind of stuff. Is there anything in the brain that has a point of view? Is there anything in the brain that isn't open to everybody's inspection equally? The facts of the brain are objective facts. They're not subjective. They're open to everybody to see in exactly the same way. You don't have to think yourself into the point of view of the guy whose brain you're looking at. Just take pictures and write a paper. So there's an essential difference between the facts of experience that you're trying to find and the facts of the brain where you're looking. The facts of the brain where you're looking are objective. They're equally available to everybody's point of view. They look the same from everybody's point of view. The facts of experience are subjective. The experience of a creature is only from his point of view. If you leave out his point of view, you've left out the identity of the experience. So it seems that the facts about the brain aren't the right kinds of facts to use to discover the facts of experience. The facts of experience have a crucial link to a point of view. The facts of the brain have no point of view whatsoever that's relevant to them. That's why science is objective. It's objective because it looks the same to everybody. That's part of what objective means. But the facts of experience don't look the same to everybody. To appreciate your facts of experience, I gotta get out of my point of view and into your point of view. Because looking at it from my point of view, I won't get your experience. They definitely don't look the same to everybody. So Nagel said, here's an objection in principle against finding experience in the brain. Experience, facts of experience are one kind, and facts of the brain are a different kind, and they're so different that it just seems... Now, of course, you can always discover that this is a revolutionary way to do these things. But at present, there seems to be apples and oranges. We don't have a clue how to find in an objective batch of facts about the brain and its cells a description of essentially subjective facts about experience. So these are contemporary, very respectable, by very eminent, respected philosophers, reasons to think that your conscious experience is not in the brain. And if you tell the cognitive scientists, tell you, oh, come on, we've all discovered it, and tell them, listen, you discovered it in your dreams. But these guys know everything that you've written, everything you've taught, and it ain't there. That's one set of evidence for the existence of the soul. And next time, if you don't float it down, I'll give you some more.
Thank you.